So what happened in India was that these farmers throughout the central Indian belt were getting into this awful cycle of using GMO cotton, getting into debt to buy the cotton seeds and the chemicals that went with it, and basically ruining themselves and their communities financially and committing suicide. It was just awful. It was called the suicide belt.
Okay, so most of us understand the value of organic food. The team at Mighty Good Undies believes that buying organic textiles is just as important for your health as it is for the health of the planet. Your skin is your body's largest organ. It just makes no sense to clothe it in toxic chemicals, right? Mighty Good Undies is an Australian fair trade organic cotton brand. It offers ethical underwear at high street prices, that's their idea. It's pretty new. It was just launched last year by Elena Antoniou and Hannah Paris, but I reckon you've probably heard about it because they've got these awesome campaigns and they're very, very strong on social media. In this episode, we meet Hannah, an Australian based in London. She has a PhD in economics, but she swapped academia for making knickers because she is a passionate greenie. And Hannah saw the potential to tell the story of cotton through the brand.
Hello, Hannah, and welcome to Who Made My Clothes.
Hi, it's really great to be here.
We are recording this very special series because it's Fashion Revolution Week.
Yay, love it.
Why are you a fashion revolutionary?
Oh, it's probably easier to answer that question by saying, how could you not be?
Yeah.
The fashion industry is something that we engage with every single day, whether we think we do or not, because we all get dressed. All of our clothes come from somewhere. They're either grown or they're produced, they're processed, and they're manufactured by somebody. And each of those stages have this enormous environmental and social impact. So I became a fashion revolutionary because I started to learn about those impacts and wanted to do something about them.
Yeah, that's cool. I think lots of people can relate to that, that as soon as you find out incrementally a little bit here, a little bit there, then you start to want to agitate for change and make things better.
Yeah, and one of the really fun things about the fashion revolution movement is that fashion is actually really fun and it's part of our culture, it's part of who we are, it's a part of how we express ourselves. So there's a real fun element.
I love that you said that.
Yeah, no, I spend lots of my time looking through fashion websites pretending it's work. It's great.
Hannah, you wrote a great piece which I read on the Fashion Revolution blog last year about campaign theory.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
This comes from my background as a political activist in Australia. There's a lot of different theories about how people might campaign, and probably the most successful one around at the moment is an idea that we campaign from our authentic selves, okay. That we campaign through shared visions with other people, shared connections, shared ideas. And so that particular blog was around a technique that I had learned as an activist to try and talk to people about why I voted Green and why I supported the Greens Party. And it was a way of establishing connection with other people. And then I just thought, well, that's exactly what we're trying to do in the fashion revolution movement. We want to talk to each other, but we also want to talk to other people.
So what exactly is it? So it's about being relatable, but what form does it take?
Yep. So basically it has three stages. First of all, we talk about a challenge that we have with our particular issue with fashion and how that affected us. And the second stage is how we got to a decision point, a turning point, so to speak, where we committed to a more sustainable or more sustainable way of doing things. And the third stage is basically taking that and relating that to the person that you're talking with. So it's a way of showing that person that all this stuff that's around actually relates to somebody that they know,
yeah.
And can be boiled down to something that's really concrete.
Yeah.
And that then gets people over the kind of ooh, that's weird phase, and then also gets them from the depressed, I can't do anything
yes.
stage to, oh, actually, there's something concrete that I can do. And you can basically do that within a 2 or 3 minute conversation.
Do you just rail up to bowl up to people at cocktail parties and then put in campaign theory into action?
I can, yeah, sometimes I do.
I like the idea of that. You're like, hi, let me tell you an experience that I had. This is how it changed me and this is what I want you to do.
People might back away at 1,000 paces. I have been known to do that.
Good on you. We all know that Rana Plaza was a big thing in terms of mobilising people in support of the ethical fashion movement. Mm-hmm. And the work that Fashion Revolution does around Who Made My Clothes is big stuff. But why else? Why? What are some of the other reasons that you think people are getting more on board with these issues?
There are two things, I think, that are going on here. People are not only aware of the social impact of their clothes, but also the environmental impact of their clothing. All textiles require an enormous amount of energy and resources to go into processing them, even the natural ones like cotton or wool. And so people are starting to understand that and want to do something about that. But I also think people are just sick of consumerism. Mm. I think they're finding this ongoing fast fashion, ongoing turnover of fashion, really empty emotionally. And I think they want to get back in touch with something that's more meaningful for them and for the people around them and their community. So I think those three things together are really starting to drive some of the great activities and movement behind Fashion Revolution.
Great answer. Consumerism can be exhausting, can't it? It's quite tiring.
It is. It's really tiring. And there's a real empowerment around saying no to it. I have, over the past few years, have started to implement my minimalist wardrobe and what that means. It's actually quite hard because you personally have to let go of that feeling of I feel inadequate or I feel like I want to do something, so I'll go out and buy something. You know, it's so ingrained in us culturally. To let that go requires a lot of self-reflection and energy. But once you do that, it's so empowering. And I say to people, I have not quite, but I'm aiming for 7 outfits per season. Right, I keep them. I put them in storage in the out-of-season time because there's only 7 days of the week. So what else can you wear? And they looked at me shocked. And I say, well, do you notice that I wear this all the time? And they're like, really?
They don't notice. Yeah. Hannah, it's so interesting that you raise that because while you were speaking, I was thinking about this vlogger who is attached to Refinery29, the media company in the US. And she basically trials different lifestyle ideas. And I watched one recently where she tried to wear the same outfit every day for 5 consecutive days.
Yes.
And one of the big takeaways she had from it was that nobody noticed.
Nope, nobody and notices.
She works in this big media company, which is very fashion driven. And mostly her colleagues just had no clue that she was wearing the same T-shirt, same jeans, same jacket every day. So it was all about self-perception and not about other people's perceptions at all.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And if you feel if your clothes work for you, they suit you, they make you look and feel great, then essentially you're going to get dressed. My aim is always to get dressed and then move on with my day and forget about what I'm wearing. Like, I'm so comfortable in what I wear and it makes me feel great that I just get on with pretty much more important things in the day.
It's so hard for me. I'm a freaky magpie. I want to wear all the things all the time and I want them to be all sparkly.
Well, you know, accessories, you know, if I do really feel the urge to buy something, I often go and buy pantyhose. It's like to chat or socks or something like that, something small.
Or mighty good undies.
Or mighty good undies. Yes, a new pair of underwear. Yep.
I want to talk about the little things. I want to talk about Mighty Good Undies, mm-hmm. which you co-founded with Elena Antoniou.
Yes.
How did you guys meet?
We met because I wanted to develop an underwear brand. And my experience with my other business was that I really needed to develop a partnership and a team around this concept. And
because you'd been a lone wolf.
Yeah, I'd been a lone wolf. And I thought mistakenly that, you know, I couldn't work with anybody else because I'd dilute the ideas, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, so wrong, so wrong. And so I started looking around for somebody who would complement my skills and basically in marketing and PR because I'm not great at that side of things. A mutual contact introduced us.
Was it Yatou Widdershunt?
Yes, it was. I call her the grandmother or the auntie. Auntie, yes, the auntie, of Mighty Good Undies, yes. So,
and Yatou is an activist. And a writer and an ethical fashionista.
She was the lovely woman who introduced us. And then we slowly started working together and getting to know each other over a 6-month period. And we got to the point where we were just working really well. And it's just taken off from there.
Now, Elena isn't with us today. So if you could sum her up for listeners in perhaps one sentence, which is tricky.
Creative, energetic, has a really clear vision of what she wants and just goes for it.
You guys have incredible social media, and I know that that's a lot
that's
of that's down
to her. Yes. Yeah, I'm not going to take the credit for it. That is mainly to her. She has this incredible ability to just tap into the zeitgeist. I'm too much of a nerd, you know, to do that. I hang around with other nerds. She does that side of the business.
But you guys are a power dynamic duo, which I love.
Yeah, we complement each other really well, which is fantastic.
How do you work together? Because you, Hannah, are, although you were based in Sydney, now yes. based in London.
Yes.
And Elena is based here in Sydney.
Yes.
How do you divvy up responsibility and work together?
Basically, I look after the production and the finance and sort of admin side of things, and Elena looks after PR, comms and marketing side of things. And we essentially got to the point in our relationship that we trusted each other to do what we needed to do.
Let's talk about the name Mighty Good Undies. I yes. love it. I'm English. Undies is such an Australian word. How does it go down in London? Do people understand it?
Yeah, they do, actually.
And are they adopting it?
Yeah, they do. I mean, we got that feedback a little bit about underwear, but in a way, I mean, we started in Australia, so it sort of keeps that particularly Australian dynamic. And I kind of like it. And the UK is such a multinational country now. There's people from all over the world, particularly around London, but also in other big cities that most people get it.
And most people grew up with neighbours, let's face it.
Yes. Oh, well, that is true too. Yes. Yes, yes. I get looked at oddly when I say I don't like the beach. They're like, really? Australians
Seriously,
don't like
I grew
the beach?
Up, they're like, you're Reg Grundies. I get that because I know yes. all about neighbours.
Yes.
Can you share the thinking behind the brand and what it is you aim to do with Mighty Good?
Yeah, sure. So I was working in ethical fashion before, and I saw a lot of wonderful work that's been done in ethical labels right around the world, mostly at the high price, not luxury end, but also that level below. They were doing great work, and that's where the leadership in the industry starts, and that's where it needs to start, and that's fantastic. But actually, we're getting to the point now where we need to translate that down into a mass market, because unless we do, we're not going to be able to make the changes at the scale that we need to make them at. So I started off with women's clothing, and I realized quite quickly that it's still too much of a higher price point to get people over that barrier of wanting to experiment with something. So I wanted to develop a product that was small enough, cheap enough to produce and to sell, that people could go, oh yeah, I can spend, you know, $16 on something to experiment with it and see what it's all about. So underwear was kind of the perfect choice for that because it is small. It's a need, you know, something like 95% of people wear underwear. I don't know what the other 5% do. But it taps into a real consumer need. It's a consumer basic. People love buying upcycled, recycled clothing, secondhand, whatever. They're never going to buy secondhand underwear. So it was kind of the perfect vehicle to be a breakthrough product into this market.
Why do you think then that there has been such a lack of sustainably produced underwear?
I don't know. I mean, I think there are a few now, but I think maybe because people who go into this space are really interested in the fashion side of things. And so, you know, there's not a hell of a lot of creativity you can do with a pair of knickers. You know, the basic shape, size, colour, compared to, say, designing a dress or trousers or whatever like that. So maybe that has something to do with it.
And I should just make clear that Mighty Good is not just women's wear, it's also men's wear.
Yes, we have our boy trunks and knickers. Yep.
Boy knickers. Let's talk about a bit more about that idea of sustainably produced underwear and what it means. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, there was a class action brought against Victoria's Secret over skin irritations thought to be caused by formaldehyde in bras. The action was dropped and it wasn't proved. But, you know, you hear these things again and again. Yeah. I personally worry about azo dyes and just the lack of transparency in some of this stuff. Your skin is your biggest organ.
It is. It's very important. So that was a really big concern for me as well. Chemicals both in the use of producing the cotton as well as the chemicals that are used in the dyeing process and the processing elements of getting it from the cotton plant to knickers. So we use a system called the Global Organic Textiles System. The way the GOTS system works is that it specifically bans a whole range of classes of chemicals. You have to almost be a chemist to understand what's going on. So azo dyes are banned, formaldehydes are banned, polyphenols are banned, chlorine is banned, and there's a whole range of them. And it also then bans a whole lot of chemicals based on their effects. So things that bioaccumulate and create problems are banned, things that are endocrine disruptors, things that are cancerous. The standard is updated on a reasonably regular basis. It's run by the four major organic certification agencies in the US, Japan, Germany, and the UK. So they come from very trustworthy sources. So that's how we manage it, basically, by going to a supply chain that we know has taken all that stuff out and we don't have to worry about it, and it's great.
That's brilliant, and thank you for explaining that, because it's not something that everybody knows. We know GOTS is good, tick.
Yes.
But to actually hear exactly why, I think, is powerful. The story of conventionally produced cotton is one of massive water use and chemical use on crops. And yet I think many people, including me before I started researching this stuff, presumed that because cotton was a natural fibre, it was therefore good.
Yep. Cotton is a natural fibre. It's fantastic. And it's been used by humans for thousands and thousands of years. In the current contemporary market, I mean, it's a crop that is very prone to insects. So that's why a lot of insecticides and pesticides are used. And it's quite a thirsty crop as well. And in addition to that, 95% of the cotton crop is also GMO modified. You know, at best we can say it's unknown, untested environmental impacts, as well as creating a whole lot of economic dependencies, particularly for developing country farmers.
And much of that cotton is BT cotton, right, which Monsanto messed around with in order to
take on the battle
of the bollworm, which basically means that farmers have to use a Monsanto product in order to kill those pests.
Yes. So what happened in India was that these farmers throughout the central Indian belt were getting into this awful cycle of using GMO cotton, getting into debt to buy the cotton seeds and the chemicals that went with it, and basically ruining themselves and their communities financially and committing suicide. It was just awful. It was called the suicide belt. So the organisation that we buy our cotton from, Chetna Organics, went into those communities deliberately to try and show farmers that there was a different way of doing things. So reintroducing organic cotton agriculture.
How does organic cotton flip the system?
It does a couple of things. First of all, it encourages and builds farmers' ability to grow cotton without pesticides through things like co-planting, soil conservation, to have water retention, and to develop other forms of fertilizer and other forms of pest management.
What is co-planting when they mix different things with it, or what does that mean?
So when I visited a couple of the farming communities, they were growing their cotton with food crops. So it was not only sort of cutting down the pest problem, but also improving their food security, as well as another source of income for them as well. Organic cotton, also the way they till it and the way they actually manage the plants, it retains carbon into the soil and therefore reduces the carbon emissions from agriculture, and also reduces the amount of water that's used.
I mean, it's just obviously better, isn't it? Listening to you speak, I'm like, how could you want anything that wasn't that? So less water, managing pests in a more natural manner,
yes,
and removing or reducing chemicals in the supply chain.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Why aren't we just only using organic cotton?
Well, this was it. And the farmer said to me, you know, I was sitting in a field. It was a really pivotal, it was one of those moments, actually, that you just go, right, my life has to change. And I was sitting in a field with them, and they said, oh, well, we love growing organically, and it's not because it's cool or hip or whatever reasons why we might do it. It's because our health costs are lower. You know, we don't necessarily get a higher price for our organic cotton because there's not enough demand for it, but our health costs and our input costs are so much lower, so our profitability is much higher, and they feel better, obviously, because they're not sick all the time from the chemicals that they were using before. And they said, but not enough people are demanding the cotton and they aren't paying for it. And so we need to increase the demand for this product. And I'm just like, right, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. So that was my turning moment. Yeah.
Hannah, what took you to Chetna Organics in the first place?
When I was researching my supply chain for Audrey Blue, I quickly found out that India is the centre of the organic cotton world. It produces the most organic cotton in the world. It's also a place where cotton has been grown and processed for thousands and thousands of years. So I just did my research, and Chetna Organics was one of the major suppliers and has a fantastic reputation, works with a lot of international brands already, has a fully integrated supply chain with processors and with producers. And it was just basically a supply chain that you know, all you needed to do was go there and say, okay, I'm going to put it in order for this.
And I want to get back to your women's wear label, mm-hmm. Audrey Blue.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, just tell me a little bit more about Chetner Organics. Where is it? And how did you just arrive and be there and get in the fields? How do you do that?
Lots of emails. Lots and lots of emails. So their central office is in Hyderabad in India, which is an incredibly fascinating city. So I emailed them and said, oh, I'm coming to India. Can I come and visit you?
Did they just say yes?
Yeah, they just said, yeah, come along. I turned up and I was talking to their CEO and I asked whether I could go and visit a farm. So he just rang up one of his field operatives and said, oh, I'm coming.
Hannah's coming.
Yeah. So they just showed me around the villages and I saw some of the work that the fair. So these farmers, they grow organic cotton, but Chetner also organises them into fair trade cooperatives so that they can negotiate better prices for their cotton. And it also connects them with international NGOs and with international brands to develop particular projects. So this particular village that I went to had developed grain and cotton storage facilities from their funds and from their brand partners. And they had also developed things like an after school care program for the kids, because all their kids were running around the village while their parents were in the cotton fields and they were concerned about what would happen to them. So they had an after school care program.
It is a holistic approach, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's really driven by the farmers themselves. They all keep their own logbooks. They all have to keep their own logbooks, and they all run the organisations. Mm. It's quite incredible to think that a farmer who basically runs a farm that's, you know, 1 acre wide, you know, 1 acre big, runs a national cotton organisation. Yeah.
So. You mentioned kids running around. What were you like as a kid running around, Hannah? What kind of kid were you? And can you tell me a bit about your childhood and, you know, where you began?
I was probably quite a pain in the ass, I think, if you ask my mother. Our family were always very politically aware, so it was in the zeitgeist for me to pick that up. And I picked that up quite early, I think, and I was always a bit of a rebel. So, I think my first independent political actions were when I was 13, 14, I joined Amnesty International and I used to write letters. You know, they used to send out newsletters, this was before the internet, and they used to write like emergency appeals.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I used to do that every week and take all my letters up to the post office in my school uniform to get them sent off to, you know, governments all around the world. And then quickly after that, I got into being an environmentalist, particularly sort of wilderness protection, and I've kind of been around that sphere on and off ever since.
And you studied in that realm. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I studied economics and geography, human geography, which is sort of studying the relationship between humans and the environment, because I wanted to save the world by changing government and changing policies, et cetera, et cetera. So I did that for a very long time, and I ended up doing a master's and a PhD in it.
And did you do that in London?
Yes, so I studied for my master's in London, in the London School of Economics, and then my husband came over and proposed. So instead of staying, I came back to Australia to do PhD. And then I kind of worked in it, and then one day woke up and said, oh, you know what? I want to go into business.
But before you thought you were going to go into business, I happen to know, because we did discuss this before we recorded, that you had a lively interest in tuna.
Yes, I had tuna to cotton. I have the most unusual background, I think, in this in the fashion industry. So I did my PhD looking at cooperative transboundary management of tuna fishing resources in the Western and Central Pacific Ocean.
Whoa, wow.
Specifically looking at a fisheries commission. So the fisheries world, the international fisheries world, is divided up into fisheries commissions, where all the countries who have an interest in the fishery get together and do cooperative management. So I was looking at that particular arrangement. They usually do it pretty badly. This one is better than others, but it's still not great. And so I spent a lot of time in the Pacific. I was very, very lucky to be able to travel around the Pacific, talking to people, working with people in the tuna industry, and understanding how that industry works.
And understanding, presumably, the environmental impacts of fishing or of potentially overfishing and managing the oceans.
Yes. So depending on how the fish is caught, there's more or less environmental impact of the tuna that we buy and eat, and sort of understanding those and understanding ways of which we could minimise those, but also trying to make sure that the stock, the tuna stock, is actually sustainable as well. It's a very valuable fish as well as being a very beautiful animal. So we don't want to drive it to extinction.
Can I ask you a question that's off message because I've always wanted to know and I worry about it every day? I have two cats and most of their fish is tuna. I read it on the can and freak out because surely we're overfishing tuna and the cat should not be eating it. What's the answer?
So it depends on the stock. If it just says tuna, it's more than likely to be skipjack tuna, which is the smaller species. And it was described to me that they breed like rabbits. So they're more likely to be fished sustainably as long as they're fished in a particular way. So what I do when I buy my tuna is I look for MSC certified fish. I don't know if they do that in pet food because I don't have a pet. Mm. So MSC...
It's a big issue. I freak out about it all the time. And I ask the kittens, do you like this tuna enough for me to be overfishing the seas?
Yeah.
And they say yes, mama.
Well, and it's also often... it's also the trash fish, like the lower quality
That's what
fish.
I was hoping. Yeah. Oh, no, I was hoping it was just bits of that would have been thrown away.
Yeah, they would have been thrown away. Like they grade... Fish gets graded. So,
anyway, I digress. But from fish to fashion, Hannah.
Yes. So I did a very big project looking at tuna supply chains into Europe. And what really struck me was it's a commodity. You know, it gets harvested, gets processed, gets sent off to market. And I realised that cotton is pretty much the same way. It gets grown, it gets processed, it gets sent off to market, and they're all global supply chains. And once you sort of realise that, and all commodities are the same, you know, cocoa gets grown in Africa and gets processed. And so once you realise that, it wasn't a very big jump between learning about tuna and learning about...
You took it a step further because instead of consulting on supply chains for other people, you actually began your own label.
Yes, yes, because I wanted to be involved. I got a bit sick of the politics and the policy and a bit disillusioned with it. And I wanted to develop a business where I knew that I could contribute something that was positive. I mean, while I still believe in public policy, it's very hard to see the impact of what you do because, you know, it could be years, even decades before you see an outcome. And I'm too impatient. I want to see the results. I want to see the outcome of what I do. So I wanted to develop a business where I could see the outcomes.
So what exactly did you do? Share a little bit about your label, which I know is on hiatus now, but does inform some of the work that you're doing now.
Yeah. So I wanted to develop a women's label that was a step down from kind of fashion. I describe it in a way that when we go out to eat, chefs make our food. And to me, that's fashion. You know, it's that beautiful, well-designed, thoughtful, put-together stuff that looks fabulous, it feels fabulous, etc. But actually, when we go home, we cook. We don't chef. And actually, mostly what we do is wear clothes. We don't wear fashion. We will, you know, when we're going out, we're getting dressed up, but essentially we wear clothes. So I wanted to develop a brand that was very clothes-oriented and much more accessible both in price points and styles to women who wouldn't necessarily be interested in fashion, but interested in ethical side of things. So that's how Audrey Blue got started.
And you also focused more broadly on the idea of ethical and of sustainable, I suppose. I think you can use those words to talk about this idea of a size range and clothes that are built to be outside of seasonal trends.
Yes, absolutely. Everything that I design is about making sure that customers and women can wear them for seasons and seasons. We all have that favourite piece that we've, you know, had for years, and that's the kind of pieces that I wanted to develop. Seasonal and also designed in a way that suited different body shapes and different sizes. I think sometimes brands only focus on a particular body shape and a body style. I wanted something that was a little bit more broader than that.
How have you applied that thinking to Mighty Good?
We have 5 different styles of underwear for women, which is one of our points of difference with other ethical brands, because whenever you ask women what their favourite style is, you're going to get a different answer. And that's because everybody has different body shapes and different preferences. And, you know, Elena and I were initially talking through what styles we wanted, and what she likes is completely different to what I like. And I thought, well, why can't we accommodate everybody's tastes? So we go from a size 8 to a size 22 in Australia. At the moment, we don't have every single style produced, but we will eventually have those 5 different styles produced. So you can go from anything from a thong, which I wouldn't I wouldn't wear in a pink fit, I must say, to my old faves, which are the granny knickers, which actually are really good sellers.
Which I've got, and yeah. They're great.
So the philosophy is everyone's accommodated. We have an inclusive brand. Regardless of what body shape or body type you are, there'll be something in it for you. Men are easier. their body shapes and types don't have such a wide variation.
Hannah, having worked in the fashion space for how many years now?
Oh, me.
Or the clothing space, if you like.
On and off since about 2010, I think.
What drives you mad about the fashion industry?
Tokenism. Yeah, I think that's the thing that really drives me mad.
What makes you feel that there's hope in the fashion industry?
That there are genuine moves for change. I always get impatient that it's not fast enough, but I do see now, particularly on the social standard side of things, it's becoming less and less acceptable to be seen to be doing any exploitation or not paying your workers properly. How that translates into real action, that's another thing, but it's actually less acceptable now. It's a real cultural shift.
Can fashion be political?
Oh, absolutely, it is. Gosh, where do you start with the politics? I mean, people have been using fashion for politics for hundreds and hundreds of years. The big thing that I always come back to is Catherine Hamnett's work in the 1980s. Yeah. There's a revival now of actually branded messaging T-shirts, which is great. And so message has become a fashion thing.
And she was, of course, one of the first people to try to be an early adopter of organic cotton, and she kept getting doors slammed in her face because people thought she was nuts.
Yes.
So we have moved on.
Yes. Yeah, we have moved on. I mean, sourcing organic T-shirts and basic organic stuff is much easier these days. Sourcing other organic items is a bit harder, but you know, we're working on that.
So just finally, fashion revolution. Let's get one.
Yay! Yes.
What will you personally be doing to support Fashion Revolution Week this year?
We have a new campaign coming out called Bear for Good. So we will be releasing that. We'll also be in the 2017 Australian Fashion Report, and so we'll try and do some media around that. Being at Elena's wedding. So, yeah.
At which you could probably turn inside out for social media.
Yes, we're I'm trying to convince Elena that she needs to wear her wedding dress inside out, at least for a couple of photo shoots. I've actually made my dress for the wedding.
Have you? Oh, gorgeous.
Yeah, I'm actually experimenting now with zero waste design. So that's sort of a really exciting new development.
In terms of how you cut or in terms of using materials that are repurposed?
How you cut. So it's basically whole cloth. So what I'm wearing at the moment is...
Hannah just put her arms in the air and I just thought she was stretching, but she was in fact showing me a top Is it a dress?
I can't see. It's made from linen. It's from a fabulous Swiss brand called Jungle Folk. I think they had this in their last year's collection. But yeah, there's a growing movement around designing clothes where you minimise or even eliminate the wastage you get on the fabrics, and it's fantastic. So yeah, I've been doing a little bit of experimenting around that.
You could check out this great girl called Casey Devlin.
Oh.
And she just won the National Designer of the Year Award, which is an industry thing that happens every year.
Yeah,
I want to say the Tiffany National Designer of the Year Award, but it probably isn't even them anymore. Anyway, she won it, Casey Devlin. Very, very clever person. And she originally began with no fastenings, so no zippers. Yes. It's conceptual and clever, but she pleats and she wraps and she is always thinking about having no waste and making something very beautiful that doesn't need conventional construction or extraneous bits and bobs.
I think it's so exciting. And as somebody pointed out to me a while ago, cutting into fabric is a very Western notion. If you look at African or Indian women and how they wear their clothes, they don't cut into clothes.
Fascinating.
This is what we're getting back to before, which is about fashion is about who we are, how we represent ourselves in the world. It's about our culture. So, I love that element of it too.
Hannah, we could talk to you all day. I don't want to stop, but we must stop. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with Who Made My Clothes. Who Made My Clothes is a co-production between Jackrabbit FM and Fashion Revolution Australia and New Zealand. It's hosted by me, Claire Press from Wardrobe Crisis, and produced by Brooke McCallery. Editing is by Ryan Pemberton and Brooke McCallery. And you can find out more about the show and about all the brands that we feature by hopping onto the Fashion Revolution website.
Thank you to The Hipstones for the music, This track is Read Your Mind from the album Wise Man, available on iTunes or Spotify. To hear more, go to thehipstones.com. To find out more information and to take part in Fashion Revolution Week, head to the website. It's fashionrevolution.org and you need to search for Australia or New Zealand. On social media, search for the hashtags Who Made My Clothes and Fashion Revolution, and you'll find heaps of inspiration as to how you can get involved.
Jackrabbit FM.
For your ears.
Who is that? Hi, Puck Pass.